This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal. And despite all the crowing by the federal government about tightening bail conditions, we have another shooting, allegedly, by a suspect out on bail for firearms offenses, for serious criminal firearms offenses. And he shot a cop, allegedly, over an e-bike. Police have identified him as a 27-year-old man who was out on bail and wanted on two separate warrants in Peel and Waterloo. Meanwhile, there have been four fires caused by those e-bike batteries in about 24 hours. So there's no question that it's a crisis. And we'll be talking to the acting deputy fire chief as well as the panel on this. And I also want to talk about some of the latest things coming out of the mayor's race. So just this week, Olivia Chow's main challenger, Brad Bradford, announced that if he's elected, he is going to rip out the much maligned bike lanes on Bloor Street West. And he admitted that when they originally came up before council, he was in favor of them and he voted yes. Here's what he had to say.
These bike lanes out in Bloor West and Etobicoke are not working. And so, you know, I voted for these 3 years ago along with the majority of council, and we did that in good faith. We did that based off of a plan. But what we know now with the evidence, with the experience from hearing from people on the ground is they're not working. And so I think it is incumbent on people in leadership positions to recognize and have the humility to acknowledge when something's not working and the courage to go back and fix it.
Okay, so that's what he said about it. I was interested in the way his opponents framed this. So first of all, they ran clips of him supporting this and trumpeting this back when it first came up. And one of the things that is a criticism is that they say that he is just opportunistically telling people what they want to hear. And it has me scratching my head a bit. I'm saying, is it bad to actually give taxpaying voters what they want as opposed to what they should want according to the left-wing ideologues that run council? So people, I'd like to know what you think. Is it good when you see a politician admitting they made a mistake and walking it back, or is it a sign that they are lying in the first place? So the numbers to call, 866-744-740. That is our text line, our long distance phone line, 416-360-0740.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome Toronto City Councillors James Pasternak, Ward 6, York Centre, Stephen Holliday, Ward 2, Etobicoke Centre, and Mike Cole, Ward 8, Eglinton Lawrence, and Deputy Mayor for North York. And I think we have to start with this latest police shooting. Again, a suspect out on bail and for previous firearms offenses. I mean, Mike?
This makes me want to throw up. Really, this has been going on in all the shootings. You know, I've talked about it before, the shooting up at my Old Avenue restaurant. The guy had three first-degree murder charges. He was out. Every one of these, you know, the St. Clair Salsa people, all with previous records, all out on bail. There should be a moratorium on any bail for any gun crimes. There's got to be a moratorium now. And that's not only the feds, it's also the provincial JPs to let everybody out. So we need to stop this dangerous practice, because there seems to be no connection between our judges, JPs, our court system, and reality. They are putting not only our police in danger, they are putting the public in danger with this, you know, free for all on bail.
I have to say, in addition to this, and we heard from the police association chief, and we heard from one of the police spokespeople, but I heard the mayor, Olivia Chow, and she's saying, well, we've spent a lot of money on after-school programs and other programs, and, you know, I'm just shaking my head, James.
Yeah, no, that... I mean, this guy's 27 years old, you know, some kind of basketball after school program or finger painting in a high school is not going to stop this guy from committing crimes. I agree with everything Mike has said. I mean, it is crazy out there the way we're letting dangerous people who have a history of violence, a history of gun violence, back onto the streets so easily. And it's a broken judiciary and it's a broken system. That is soft on the criminals, and you know, where are our rights? The rights are for the criminals and the angry mobs. Where are the rights of the rest of us and police services to go about our daily lives in peace and security without these criminals back out on the streets so easily? So it takes all three levels of government, as Mike and I have been saying for over a year now. A strategic path, mostly the provincial and federal government, because the municipal has limited a role in setting bail regulations. But it is outrageous. An after school program is great for little kids in a K-8 environment, maybe even high school. I was a former trustee. That's a good thing. But in these situations, it will not solve the problems we're facing.
Stephen. I mean, you know, we've talked before about the finger pointing, you know, among the three levels of government and the police. So how does this get fixed?
There's two points to the story that I want to focus in on. I can talk about them generally, right? It's not just about this one thing that happened. A while ago, I had an opportunity to pick up a handgun in my hands in an inappropriate setting. It was an armory. It wasn't loaded. And the thing that I'll never forget about it is that it's a very heavy piece of metal. And it's not something that you would put in your pocket and forget. And so anyone that gets up in the morning and puts a handgun into their pocket, into their waistband, or you know wherever they hide it, and strolls out of their home has made very deliberate choices. It's not something that you forgot that was in your pocket from the night, you know, at the shooting range the night before, right? So someone has made that choice. And the second part of this story, and unfortunately part of others, is that they discharged it towards a police officer while they were doing their job, you know, interdicting a crime. And that's also concerning, and that fuels the larger picture with how people feel insecure in society. And so they always go back to the question of, you know, why do people make choices like this or are alleged to have made choices like this? And one has to wonder, like, is there no fear about being caught or no fear on consequences? And that's the starting point. I mean, we can talk about funding the police and having all the tools in place, technologies to try to reduce this. But you have to address the person's choice at the start of it. And My goodness, like so many things, there has to be this fear of consequences. And I think that's where things need to be fixed. And, you know, I hold the federal government, to the extent that the provincial government contributes to the process, all accountable for that. And I don't want to forget those two points, because they're such simple elements to this. But when you put yourself through the motions of what happens in these types of situations, they're just the human choice.
Okay. Let us go to the phones. We've got Clayton in Richmond Hill. Hi, Clayton.
Hello. The way I was raised, I mean, if you spoke back to a cop, my butt would be a little red for about a month. You just don't do that kind of stuff. I'm old school, you know, in the sense the way I was raised. But for anyone to ambush a police officer and injure them severely, as if that person should go to jail, period. Minimum 25 years. No parole. You can't apply for 25 years. You're in. Because these people put their lives at risk every day, and this is what they get back in return as a thank you? Wow.
Okay.
So I appreciate what the police do. I just wanted to say that very straightforward. I appreciate what they do, and thank you so much for letting me make that comment.
Okay. Thank you for that. I'd like to read a text from Jason. He says, why can't the judges, I guess, and the JPs, who grant bail to the repeat offenders be held accountable? That's also a good question. I mean, we have an independent judiciary and we want an independent judiciary, but some of the things that are happening here are just beyond the pale. People, I'm sure this will continue to be a topic tomorrow on Free For All Friday. Pardon?
Oh, I was just going to add, Libby, when you see the way the protesters or the mobs deal with police up at Bathurst and Shepherd, they're totally disrespectful. They have no respect for the role the police play and the risks they take. And that has been allowed to go on. And unfortunately, that is part of the problem we're having in society, where police, as this caller said, has a certain stature that was respected. And if you crossed it, you would be in big trouble. And that seems to have melted away.
Hmm. Okay, turning to one of the other topics. This is for Holiday as well. So what do you think about Brad Bradford saying he'd rip out those particular bike lanes?
Oh, goodness. Great. but I wish the quote was played of me warning council not to do it when it was first voted in, because it was wildly unpopular. And it was largely unjustified because the ridership was so low. It was right in the information. But council went ahead. I think the center politics on this, though, and the most important part of the story, yes, this is vastly unpopular out in the West End and will attract voters. But I think it's a recognition of the feeling of people about how their city hall is off track and is doing things against their wishes and imposing things on them. And the more that gets recognized in a mayor's race, and the more that the candidates can try to reconcile that difference, that is the fabric of democracy. And, you know, I'm glad it's being talked about. I guess the next move then is over to the mayor and her campaign about how she's going to reconcile those differences. And they're in a lot of things, right? It's not just bike lanes, but, yeah, you know, it could be about taxes. It could be about planning changes in sixplexes, all that kind of stuff, where people feel like City Hall has been making moves that are not in their interest or their wishes.
Right.
And I see that divide between downtown and suburbs a lot.
Yeah. Mike, what's your take? I mean, this is what he's being criticized for, is changing his mind and also giving people what they want. And that doesn't happen often enough, according to a lot of residents.
Yeah, well, I think, Brad, came up and stated some facts. We were told as a council that this would help alleviate traffic congestion, that, you know, bike lanes would be used as one of these tools. And he's looked at it and said it hasn't done what the professional staff at the city said would happen. It hasn't, reduced congestion. In fact, in some ways, it's created more congestion because you eliminated a lane. So good for Brad for saying, he voted for it, but now he wants to take them out. And we've got a new reality here. We've got the provincial government stepping in now and determining where bike lanes can go in the city. So this is, again, the background of this is the that, you know, the city has been facing massive congestion issues. Bike travel was supposed to be, along with transit, one of the ways of dealing with it. And, you know, we all have to re-examine these initiatives. I know in Eglinton, there were supposed to be bike lanes after the long-awaited Eglinton Crosstown was put into place. Well, I made sure that they didn't go in because the circumstances changed. So the big section of Eglinton, there are no bike lanes. So we have to give Brad credit for looking at the results and and changing his mind. But why not if it's the right thing to do?
Okay, let's take a call from Sam in Toronto. Hi, Sam.
Hello, good morning. I mean, good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, to make it short, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, City Hall culture is about contempt, I say it. You know, it's like a contempt for the majority of Torontonians. It's, you know, if you bend to their ideological, as you said, ideological, you know, thing, then if you confirm, you know, then you're part of a crowd. If not, they are detached from reality, whether it's bike lane, whether it's their unresponsive constructions, city constructions that last for months, and they don't even answer to the public when it's going to end. They have no deadline because they want to just do it the way they want. So all these things goes back to the fact that they have no respect for public opinion. They think they know better, and everyone should just follow their leads because they think better, you know? And that's how it is. That's all I have to say.
Okay, Sam, thank you for that. Brian and Alliston on Brad Bradford. Kudos to Brad Bradford for his honesty and responsiveness to his constituents. Most politicians, in my experience, would attempt to obfuscate the history of the original decision and blame someone else. If I still lived in Toronto, in brackets, shudder, I'd definitely be voting for Brad. Okay, well, we are also interested in people who are voting in Toronto. So this is still a topic. It will be a topic on Free for All Friday. Let me give the numbers out again, 866-744-740. That's our text line, 416-360-0740. And James, what do you think of that, about backtracking on bike lanes or whatever else? I mean, after all, Doug Ford is kind of the master of that.
Yeah, I would approach this from two angles, and I think Mike touched on it. When we're in a council meeting, we see a staff report, which may run 30, 40 pages, which covers cycling recommendations across the city. And, you know, what you see on paper in a staff report is not always what works in the real world. And this was a case in point where what looked good on paper, seemed to be supportable, did not function in the real world. Regarding changing his mind, I mean, we vote 3,000 times a year, and there's not one councillor around that council chamber that did not change their mind on an issue. And I think it's commendable to say, look, what we voted on, we thought would work. It's not working, so let's fix it. And I think that's a good sign. I would say these bike lanes that are impairing emergency vehicles and people who want to get home at the end of the day or get to work, they should be removed. And we have to think anew about putting in bike lanes that impact a live lane and the flow of traffic.
Okay, I have another question for you, James. And this week we heard about, and here we reported, I think we're just about the only kind of official media person that reported it, but the establishment of a hate crimes prosecution unit. So presumably this goes directly to your area. You're talking about the mobs at Bathurst and Shepherd. A lot of people are kind of skeptical because nothing has worked before. But what's your take on this?
So we have to try everything to get to Toronto back to a place of respect, a place of civility, a place of calm. And this is one of the things that's worth trying. And I commend MPP Michelle Cooper for really championing this. But at the same time, there were a bunch of photographs of people posing. There was no Solicitor General there, and Toronto Police Services weren't there. So I asked myself, well, did they buy into this? That's something I'll just throw out there. The other thing is, we can create this unit, but hate crimes are extremely difficult to prosecute, successfully prosecute in this country. The bar to reach a hate crime is extremely high, and the courts tend to lean towards this Watcott versus Saskatchewan case from decades ago, in which the bar was so high, you could barely get a conviction. So I think we have to try everything possible. I think this is a good way to do it, because the hate law processing is kind of dysfunctional now. This may work, but once again, we're in a problem situation in which getting successful prosecution of hate crimes in this country is extremely difficult.
Well, yes. I mean, the word is that that it's up and running, that the prosecutors there are more expert in this, and they want to be there. So I guess we'll have to see. I mean, you know, hopefully it has some kind of impact. I also want to touch on these ion lithium battery fires. So we are going to be talking to the acting deputy fire chief just after this. And they're talking about regulating the batteries, because these batteries for the e-bikes have no standards attached to them, unlike the ones from our cell phones or our tablets. The manufacturing has to meet a standard. But in the meantime, Mike, all of these bikes are out there. So even if there is a change in regulation, how are we going to get this in hand? I mean, there's a blitz underway by Toronto Police now for micro mobility devices. But, you know, when the 2 weeks is over, they're not going to have the resources. So what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, we should launch a lawsuit. The city should, the province, against the manufacturers. How in the hell can we allow these dangerous explosive batteries in apartments and homes? As you know, the fire chief has said, it's the number one danger to fire protection in the city of Toronto. You know, Chief Jessup has gone on a crusade on this. And secondly, with the Wild West of e-bikes, I've said this a number of times, go after the funders of the e-bikes. The number one funders are, DoorDash, Uber Eats, all these people that hire these persons that are on our sidewalks, causing chaos everywhere. Go after them. So they get fined if their workers, the Uber workers, whatever they're called, are on the sidewalks, which there are continually. There, some corners in Toronto, you can't even walk by the corner if there's a McDonald's or something there, because they congregate and they're zipping in and out. It is mayhem. And again, go after the delivery services and go after the manufacturers of these extremely dangerous explosive lithium batteries, which are endangering lives.
Well, some of the manufacturers, you don't even know. You can buy it on Amazon by one of these third party whatevers. And a lot of those batteries are actually modified after. So it is a Wild West. And, you know, while I would agree that there has to be more regulation, a lot of these are out there. And I don't know how you put the genie back in the bottle. We only have a little bit of time left. Stephen, quickly on that.
A pressing urgent concern. So by regulating them, you describe them. You wouldn't store a jerry can in your living room or a propane cylinder. But at least when you can say what it is, then you can put rules around taking it into property, storing it in buildings, storing multiples together. Then you deal with the rule breakers. But right now we have nothing. And as a result, we have terrible fires that cost people's lives.
James?
Yeah, I would simply say that it's a very muddled regulatory framework. Let's take the e-bikes. They're legal to sell. They're legal to buy, but they're illegal to use on our roads and streets. And people don't get that. Wait a minute, this guy just sold me a bike. I'm not breaking any laws by buying it. And yet when I go in and ride it on the street, the cops are after me. So it's a dysfunctional system. The other thing is you need greater consumer protection, because if you overcharge or if you tamper with these batteries, that's when they become volatile and unstable, and that's when you're more likely to have a fire. So we clearly need the federal government to get in there, help regulate them, help ensure safety, to make sure firefighters and residents are safe.
Okay, well, we are going to be talking about that more in our next segment. And I'm just going to close things off by another text on the question about what do you think of Brad Bradford changing his mind? And it's from Jan, and it says, Brad, by changing his mind towards public interest, is honorable. And people, this is going to be a topic tomorrow. In the meantime, thank you so much, Mike Cole, James Pasternak, and Stephen Holliday. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye, Libby. Bye, Mike.
No,
bye,
no
Stephen.
No bail jail.
Take care.
No
all the best.
Jail.
Right.
No bail jail. I like it. That's easy to remember, and it rhymes. Thanks.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Okay. All those things, I think, are going to be hot topics tomorrow on Free for All Friday. In the meantime, we're taking a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to the acting deputy fire chief.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. The fire chief is calling it the biggest fire hazard, biggest safety hazard in the community, and that is the lithium ion battery fires, and they have become an everyday occurrence. There were four in the span of just 24 hours just this week. And unlike our cell phone batteries, which have to be manufactured to certain standards, there's no similar requirement for e-bike batteries, which are much bigger. Now, the chief is calling for faster changes to the legislation regulating those batteries, but will that do the trick? So people, give me a shout, 416-360-0740, toll free and text 866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Acting Deputy Fire Chief, Community Risk Reduction, Marla Freebay. Hi. Hi,
hello,
Acting.
Libby.
Hi. So, this seems like a real conundrum. On the one hand, you have the problem of these batteries, so you're calling for more regulation.
That's correct. Toronto Fire is working collaboratively with the province and with the federal government to hopefully come up with new standards and regulations that will govern what types of batteries are allowed into Canada, and as a result, improve the safety for Canadians, Ontarians, and Torontonians.
What's your reaction to seeing four in about 24 hours? I mean, what do you think when you see that?
Well, to be honest, Libby, I think we're still shocked by it. We've seen such a rise in the number of fires this year alone, 82 in total to date, that we are surprised, but at the same time, the same story is presenting itself over and over again.
And these fires are apparently more toxic, and even when they look like they've been dealt with, they can reignite, correct?
You're correct. They are highly toxic just because of the chemicals they contain, and they may appear to have been extinguished, but then can reignite and go into thermal runaway again, which is what is happening after fires and sometimes even within a fire when Toronto firefighters think they've extinguished it, only moments later to have it reignite again.
Now, changing the rules is a process, right? And not a short process necessarily.
This is true. And that's why we want to work collaboratively with our other government partners so that we can have input on what those results and what those standards are so that we end up with a solution that we can all live with.
Okay. So that's one track, but what do you do? I mean, you know, it's to a certain extent closing the barn door after the horses have escaped. It's a free-for-all out there, and there are lots of them out there. So, and what do you do about that? And that is a growing hazard.
This is true, and we're really trying to tackle this right now from a public education perspective. And we're trying to get our messaging out to the community to help keep everyone safe. So we do have a number of social media campaigns out on all of our social media channels, hopefully getting that message to Toronto.
Right. But education campaigns don't always work. And in one of these fires, you had multiple bikes there, and a lot of them are being used by people who use them, frankly, to make a living.
Yes, this is true. And obviously, we've all noticed that you go out on the city streets today and the number of e-mobility bikes are fairly prolific. And we understand that people need to make a living. But there's a right way and a wrong way to treat your lithium-ion batteries. And that's the message we're trying to get out.
Right. But okay, people have to make a living. But again, there's in the meantime, very little consequence. So are you suggesting any tougher consequence for people who soup up these batteries? And not only are they a hazard for fires, but they drive them anywhere on the sidewalk. You know, it's just complete chaos.
Well, absolutely. We'd like to see consequences for anything that's fire related, which is, you know, under the FPPA, what Toronto Fire Services can govern. And that's at this point why we're hoping and urging other partners like the provincial and federal government to hasten, regulation development so that we can get to this point where, you know, there are consequences, but there's also benchmarks that we can meet to keep the community safe.
Right. But again, what about, I mean, I was talking to some city councillors. They're talking about maybe punishing Uber or DoorDash and making regulations that these devices not be allowed in apartments or condos.
And that's something that potentially the Ontario Fire Code could include. So that's why we're working with the province on developing rules around that. So we want to explore potential changes such as limits regarding how many batteries you can store in your apartment, how many e-bikes are permitted in your apartments as well in a high-rise building. Those are the things we need to look at. And I think once in place, we'll certainly contribute to a safer city.
How long does it take to get regulations like that in place?
Well, certainly there's a lot of work and exploration, a lot of science that goes into it, and a collaboration on a provincial level for changes to the Ontario Fire Code. It can take time. And that's why, in the meantime, we want Torontonians to listen to our message and do what they can to stay safe in the moment.
Uh-huh. And what do you suggest then? What does that entail?
Well, certainly there are some very easy tips they can follow. And first and foremost would be just to use ULC-approved devices. And accessories for charging that match the e-mobility lithium-ion battery that you're charging. So we don't want people purchasing aftermarket products that potentially are cheaper that don't match the device. This destabilizes your battery, and this is what can cause it to go into thermal runaway. Even something as simple as staying in the room when you're charging your battery. That way, if it does go into thermal runaway, first and foremost, you can evacuate quickly and protect the rest of the individuals in your home or in the building. So some really simple things can make a long-term difference.
What is the price differential approximately between the good batteries or the approved batteries that you talked about and some of the aftermarket stuff?
Well, certainly there's a range in price, and it can be the difference between a $60 battery versus a $300 battery. So the prices really range in expense, and individuals are obviously purchasing things that match their budget.
So, I mean, you know, even with good intentions, people will say, gee, I can't afford the expensive batteries.
That can happen, yes. But in this case, it's absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Okay. Any other advice for people? And how can, say, if you're in a condo, or how do you know if you're close to, you know, one of these batteries that's not in the best shape?
Well, for example, if your battery's showing some instability, it might be making a hissing sound. It could start emitting smoke. Some batteries will even start to bulge. That's your first indication that there is a problem. And our recommendation is to leave the battery, unplug it, and evacuate your residence immediately, calling 911 once you get out. So that's how we would like you to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And again, anything you want to leave us with on this?
I think, you know, if you have batteries in your home and they've reached end of life, we'd like to recommend that you do not dispose of your batteries in the garbage or your green bin. Please take them to a City of Toronto recycling site. There are many around the city, and they will deal with your batteries in the safest way possible.
Okay. Acting Deputy Fire Chief Marla Freebe, thank you so much.
Thank you, Libby.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're taking a break. And when we come back, are you thinking of traveling to the States? Do you know people who are resuming travel to the States? You know, what do you think has happened to the avoidance of travel to the States? We were all gung-ho when the tariffs first landed on the scene and the insults from Donald Trump. You know, is all of that fizzling out now? We will tackle that when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, are you traveling to the United States? What about the people in your circle? I'm wondering if the tariff-related resolve to avoid traveling south of the border has fizzled out. Lately, I've noticed that a bunch of my friends, frankly, who might have been a little hesitant about admitting travel to the States, say about a year ago, they are just casually saying, oh, I'm just back from Philadelphia. I'm just back from Florida. I remember when the tariff-related avoidance of travel to the States was in full swing. I mean, people would be very apologetic. They'd say, I have to go. I have family. I have to go. I have a place that I now can't get rid of. And it seems to me that that has changed. So I'm wondering, what about you? And what actually do the numbers change? Because it was very recent where I saw numbers that said, gee, Canadians avoiding travel to the States is really having an impact, but maybe that's starting to reverse. So let me give you the numbers. I'd like to hear anecdotally what's happening in your life. And that is 866-740-4740, our text line, our long distance phone line. Also 416-360-4740. 1-800-273-0740. And now let's go to Devin Perry of Devin Perry Travel and Amire Lohan, President and CEO of Longwoods International. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Libby.
Can you hear me, Amir?
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so...
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. So what do the numbers say, Amir? Are Canadians, you know, are they backpedaling on this determination to avoid traveling to the U.S.?
Well, I wouldn't say backpedaling, but I think the bleeding may have stopped. You know, if you look over the past year, year and a half, since the tariffs and the trade war kind of began and the rhetoric was at its peak coming out of the U.S., depending on which source you look at, about 25 to 30% of the Canadian visitor volume had to the U.S. had just disappeared. And the intent to travel to the U.S. had plummeted significantly. We've been surveying Canadian travelers quarterly since April of last year. And our latest survey, which we just released this week, travelers...
we're losing you.
In the next 12 months.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Oh, no.
We lost you.
Apologies. Sure. 49% of Canadian travelers are telling us now that they intend to visit the U.S. in the next 12 months. That's up from 43% in April. So the trend is reversing. 28% told us that they'd actually visited the U.S. in the last 6 months, and that's up from 23% in just the last 3 months. So we're seeing many key indicators telling us that Canadians are, they may not be telling their neighbors, but they're going to the U.S. more than they were this time last year. But we still have a long way to go to recover.
Devin, what are you finding in your practice?
Yeah, I definitely think the actions are supporting the numbers. From a percentage of travel U.S. versus other places, I think that my business has increased about 300%. Just in the last week, I've booked Philadelphia, Miami, Disney, California, Savannah. So it's not even just specific places that are sort of needs-based. They are very much, which is what I was seeing before. They are very sort of leisure-based. I'm choosing to go here because that's where I want to go.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, it's interesting. I'm going to take a call from Cheryl in Thornhill. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you doing today? I know you're well.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
I have a family member, and they're going to the States all the time. It drives me nuts. I think we're losing our patriotism again because it's, you know, it's been going on long. And the people that are going there, they obviously aren't affected by the tariffs. They've got more money. And I shouldn't say more money than brains, but that's what I think. And another example was Canada Day. I have, remember when Sheila Copps was giving out the big flags? I've got one of them hanging on my front thing, and I've got a bunch of little flags. There wasn't one other flag on my street. And this was Canada Day, yet when there was soccer, everybody had flags out of other countries, whatever. But I think it's really sad that we're falling back on it. I mean, why do you have to go to... I love Disney World, but why do you have to go there at this time? And it's the dollar is terrible.
That's true.
They've got more money, then it doesn't matter anymore.
Okay, Cheryl, thank you very much for that. So I put the question back to people. What do you think of what Cheryl said? She said it is... a shame. It drives her crazy that her relatives are traveling to the United States again. I'm going to give the numbers out again. 866-744-740. That is our text line, our long distance phone line, 416-360-0740. Now, the numbers that I saw before this, Amir, show that when we collectively refused to travel to the States, it made an impact.
A tremendous impact. You're talking about $4 to $5 billion of lost economic impact here in the U.S., which means not just the money spent, tax revenue lost, jobs lost, especially a lot of our border states that...
I think we lost you again. Okay, Devin, I mean, again, the numbers, as he said, show that when we did refuse to go, it had an impact. So is this just kind of surrendering our power by sort of letting it fizzle out?
I think one of the things is that just because there's not as much sort of immediacy on the tariffs and the news as much as there was. So I think it's very easy for people to sort of push it out of mind and put their sort of own needs and emotional aspects first. Whereas when you're being frowned upon by other people to do it, I feel like that's also gone away. So there's less pressure right now to sort of leer in the other direction.
Yeah, but on the other hand, in a week, we're going to find out if there's a whole raft of new huge tariffs on things. Are people just putting that out of their mind?
The numbers and the actions are showing that they are, and it'll be interesting when that actually does come to fruition, if it does, if that actually has an impact, because I think that people are sort of living in an optimistic world where they want to do what they want to do. They want to travel to these places that they have put off potentially for a couple of years. And now they want to be optimistic that there's not something stopping them from doing it. It will be interesting to see if that is, you know, something that comes that actually is actioned, if people actually end up sort of pulling their purse strings back. When it's actually out there, it's very easy to say, oh, right now there's nothing's happening, I'm going to go. It'll be interesting to see if that changes.
Amir, we'll try you again. Can we hear you?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so you were saying that it shows that we had a big impact when Canadians were collectively refusing to go. So is this kind of return to the United States a sign that we're sort of surrendering our power? And what can we do with this power?
Well, the power is in the pocketbook always. I'm not sure it's a surrendering. There's still that 25-30% of visitation to recuperate. It's a 5% increase. It seems dramatic, but you know, we kind of hit a rock bottom there. So it's going to take a while to recover. It's not going to be an overnight thing in there. And I think, you know, unfortunately, there's new tariffs coming into effect here shortly, and so. Is that going to reverse the trend once again? So we thought we had the bleeding stopped, but we'll find out here in the next 30 days, won't we?
Okay, I'd like to read a text from Louis, which might explain how people are feeling. He says, "Hi, my friends in Florida and Pennsylvania came up to North Bay, Lake Nipissing, for a 2-week vacation at the cottage. I will be going down to the U.S. to visit them this fall. All is good in Friendsville." That's a nice sentiment. Devin, are a lot of people feeling that way?
I still think that there are pockets of people, to Amir's point, that will absolutely, under no circumstance, go to the U.S. in the current climate. I think that perhaps some of the people that are going now maybe would have gone before, and it's easy to, you know, to sort of say, I won't do something. But when the time comes to do it, what we do is often different than what we say. So as a longer duration goes by, those people that are saying stuff versus doing stuff, you know, will actually show with their actions versus their mouth. And I do think a lot of the people that wouldn't travel to the US are perhaps people that wouldn't anyways. So I think that it is going to be sort of one of those ebbs and flows based on an emotional need of wanting to go versus the conviction of not. There's people that, you know, feel really strongly in their beliefs, and there's people that, you know, live with the emotion of, I want to do what I want to do, and it is what it is.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Kathy in Otterville. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I just wanted to let you know I recently booked a trip to the U.S., and we have been avoiding travel. I'm about to retire, and I don't know. I guess it's just I'm sick of the bully U.S. telling me where I can go, and I want to go, and hopefully it's safe, and we have a fun time.
Okay, yeah, but it's not the bully U.S. telling you not to go. It's your friends and neighbors here. Does that bug you at all?
No, not really. I mean, we have many, many American friends, and I don't think they're all bad. And I just want to be able to live my life and enjoy it.
Okay. We hope you enjoy your life, too. Thanks for your call. I have a text from Dawn in Hamilton. Here's what she thinks. If you voted liberal, you staunchly avoided the U.S. If you didn't buy the, quote, elbows up nonsense, you didn't stop going to the U.S. Okay, that's Dawn's opinion. I don't think it breaks down that way personally, but we'll see. There's also a whole different kind of argument, frankly, that I'm getting at home is saying, well, the people in New York don't like Donald Trump, so let's go to New York or California. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. I think this is an interesting conversation. Again, more for tomorrow on Free for All Friday. In the meantime, thanks so much, Amira Lohn and Devin Perry.
Thank you.
Okay. That is all the time we have for Fight Back for today, Free for All Friday. Coming up tomorrow, lots of things to talk about then. I'll be back here, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.